the Tour Guide Tell All. I'm Becca.
I'm Rebecca.
And we're
the Rebeccas.
Yay! I just really want to do that. Hi, welcome to another episode of Tour Guide Tell All. We are your friendly neighborhood tour guides here to share with you some hidden and often saucy and scandalous bits of history. I am very excited about today's episode because this is the start of a month-long endeavor for us. Rebecca, you want to talk a little bit about what we're doing this month?
Yes. So August 2020 is, first of all, it's going to be very hot this month, but more importantly, it is going to be the 100th anniversary of the passage of the ratification, of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. And the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, for anyone who doesn't know, gives women the right to vote. So we are celebrating this year. Not only will it be the 100th anniversary in November when we go to the polls that women have had this right, but it was ratified in August in Tennessee. And so we are doing a month of coverage about the suffrage movement, various characters in the suffrage movement, and we're going to end with, at the end of the month, the sort of final push towards ratification in 1920. So we're all women's suffrage all the time, and it's very exciting.
This is really, really exciting. Like so many things this year, this big, huge centennial has been impacted by COVID. There were so many great museum exhibitions and programs and events that were planned all across the country. A lot of that has been canceled or scaled back or taken virtual. And so in our show notes, we're definitely going to share some links to some things that are going on in August that might be fun to take part in virtually to celebrate the centennial. But this was really a chance for us to, in my sadness of all the things I was planning to do this month, at least have a chance to really share this history. And our hope with this is to certainly talk about some people you know, but hopefully draw your attention to some of the members of this movement who are not as well known. And I think that actually brings us to our topic today, which is Elizabeth Cady Stanton. She's somebody who I feel like in the last few years, we hear more about Elizabeth Cady Stanton, but by no means does she have the fame or the notoriety of Susan B. Anthony. And I find that fascinating, and we'll talk about maybe why she doesn't have that status, that Susan B. Anthony status, which she really should, and why I think she often doesn't get a lot of attention, or she just sort of gets a mention, and there's not always a deep dive into her incredible life and work and contributions to this movement. So I think she's a really good starting point to set the stage for what we're going to talk about throughout this month. So yeah, I'm excited.
I agree. I think it's a really fun. We're going to talk about some figures you've heard about and some you haven't. And we want to do an older part of the suffrage movement. We want to do a more recent part of the suffrage movement. And by recent, I mean they were alive in 1920. We want to talk about this from the perspective of African-American women who often do get overlooked in the sort of larger suffrage movement. And we want to talk particularly about the struggle towards ratification in August of 1920. So we've got a lot going on. And we also want to do a shout out to an organization that Becca and I are particularly fond of and work closely with, which is A Tour of Her Own, which is a women's tour company in the DC area. We love them the very most, and we're actually going to have, at some point this month, I don't want to give it away, but we're going to have a special guest from Toho to help us talk about the struggle for women's suffrage.
Excellent. I can't wait. Obviously, Toho is a passion of mine, and I'm really excited that we'll be able to kind of merge it all together. So I think one of the important things to mention or to say as we get started is we talk about the 19th Amendment ratified in 1920, and I think a lot of people, when they think about the fight for suffrage, they think of maybe 10 years or 20 years or maybe a couple generations, and they don't realize that this really goes back a century in terms of an organized kind of fight, and even further. I mean, we can go all the way back to Abigail Adams and Remember the Ladies to know that even from the founding of this country, there were women saying, where do we fit in? This is a new country with new democratic ideals. Aren't we citizens? Aren't we part of this? And so Elizabeth Cady Stanton actually comes not that far after the founding generation. She's born in 1815, which a lot of historians use to mark the start of a new generation. 1815, right after the War of 1812, right after the Capitol is burned and rebuilt, is kind of the start of this new generation removed from the founding. And so there's a lot of change that happens starting from 1815 and leading us up to the Civil War. So Elizabeth Cady Stanton comes in at this time where the country is really starting to grow and it's starting to grapple with how does this democracy, this democratic republic, work in practicality? And how does it work when the founding generation is no longer here? So she's born in 1815. She's from New York. She is one of 11 children, but only five, her and four siblings, live to adulthood. So she carries a lot of burden in her lifetime. Her older brother passes away as a young man. And so she is going to feel an obligation in some ways to try to fill that role of her brother, even though the gender roles at the time make it very difficult to do so. She comes from a very privileged background. She comes from a well-to-do family. Her father is a judge and a lawyer and does instill in his daughter kind of this thirst for justice and social activism, although not perhaps pushing her to be actively engaged, but certainly wanting to make sure she was educated and understood the world around her. I love your note here that her mother's punishment for being bad was to send Elizabeth Cady Stanton to her father's office, which doesn't sound like much of a punishment if you're a bright, educated young lady.
So her father, like when I was doing research for this, I wanted to sort of pause on her dad for a minute. Her dad is a member of Congress when she's born. He's not a member of Congress long, but he's a judge and a lawyer, and he sort of very much prefers the boys. They have a bunch of boys, most of whom die as babies, and then one who lives to be about 20, and he dies of an illness relatively young. And so he seems to prefer the boys. Not that he doesn't love his daughters, but he really just prefers, sort of wants boys to carry things on. And her mother seems to have been sort of exasperated oftentimes with Elizabeth. And whenever Elizabeth wasn't doing what she was supposed to be doing, she would just tell her to go to her father's office and let her father deal with her. And his version of dealing with his child was, here, read whatever you want. Don't bother me. And so she gets to go to the office and absorb what's going on. And one of the things she remembers as an adult is she remembers that there's this one particular woman, a local woman, and they live in a fairly small town. And so she knows this woman comes in and she says, you know, my husband has died. My son, I'm a widow. My son is not giving me any money to live on. What can I do? And her father is forced to tell this poor widow, you have no recourse under the law. You can't own your own property. You've got no rights. You're basically your son's property. And this sticks with Elizabeth for the rest of her life.
Well, and I think you bring up something that's really important. And I think even for myself, you know, reminding how few legal rights women have in this era, this pre-Civil War time, this 1820s into the 1860s, I mean, things like legal divorce are essentially non-existent. If you married, you lost all rights, truly. You could not inherit anything at that point if you were married. You couldn't pursue business interests, sign a contract. You couldn't serve on juries. You couldn't go to school. There was almost no profession for you. This is very, very limiting as a citizen. And I think that she, because of the work her father did and because of the access she had, she really does get an education in this in a way that a lot of young women who were confined to sort of the domestic sphere didn't realize how few rights and how little legal protection they truly had, which is just amazing.
Right. There's no safety net. If something happens to you, there's no mechanism for you to, if you're stuck in a bad marriage, if you're a widow, there's nothing legally to help you. And she sort of sees the other side of that, this dependency, which is that she herself is, spoiler alert, going to become a mother. And she loves being a mother, but she also understands that you're walking kind of a precarious tightrope here. Like, you've got no protections for you.
Well, and certainly in her life, seeing mortality, seeing death, seeing what can happen when somebody passes away, that nothing is guaranteed. And if you don't have those legal protections, you're in trouble. I know one of the more poignant moments from her life is when her brother dies, and he is almost 20 or is 20 older than her. And, you know, her father is heartbroken at the loss of the son. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton would write in later books about her father kind of mourning the son and saying to Elizabeth Cady Stanton, oh, my daughter, I wish you were a boy. And Stanton being so heartbroken because she felt as though she couldn't fulfill that need and that role, that the family felt like her father felt like he didn't have an heir anymore because he didn't have a son. I think it's important to note, too, that her father was a slave owner. We're going to talk a little bit more about Elizabeth Cady Stanton and slavery. Slavery was legal in New York until 1827. So again, this is still very much a shifting time in the country. We have states that are starting to abolish slavery, states that are starting to grapple with this, particularly in New England and the eastern part of the United States. But her parents are not particularly abolitionist. That aspect and her connection to the abolitionist movement is going to come later through the influence of a cousin. Elizabeth Cady Stanton is going to have a formal education at Jamestown Academy. She's the only female in her math and Greek classes, which I find sort of fascinating. She was a gifted student. She won awards for debate and Greek, very talented in language. She wanted to go to Union College, which is where everybody in her class at Jamestown Academy went, and it's where her brother went, but they did not accept female students. So she decided to go to Troy Female Seminary. I hope someday to do an episode on Troy Female Seminary. It was renamed later after its founder, Emma Willard. Emma Willard was vastly ahead of her time. She was a women's rights activist. She advocated for the education of women. Troy Female Seminary had one of the more rigorous academic curriculums for women. So she's a fascinating figure. And when they renamed the school for Emma Willard in 1895, Elizabeth Cady Stanton spoke at that renaming ceremony and talked about the influence Willard had in her life and how much admiration she had. Troy was really like a training ground for an entire generation of female educators and professors, and many of the people Elizabeth Cady Stanton will have connections with later will come through friendships and social connections from Troy. I'm going to do my thing where I bring it back to Lincoln all the time. Lincoln's Secretary of State, William Seward's wife, Frances, was a classmate of Elizabeth Cady Stanton's at Troy Female Seminary. And I can't remember Frances Seward's maiden name, so it's escaping me. But before she was married to William Seward, she went to Troy and they overlapped briefly.
There's a lot. When I was doing research for this, Elizabeth Cady Stanton has some, there are some serious trivia factoids that
she's
I'm going to
draw. She's a little Forrest Gumpy in terms of like the places she intersects with all these different interesting
people. So many cool people. Yeah.
I like to mention her time at Troy too, because people here, I think that a lot of these female schools were so-and-so seminary and they think of them as religious institutions. Many of them were religious in a moral sense, but less so in a very dogmatic sense. And this is about the time that Elizabeth Cady Stanton is going to start to reject organized religion. She's going to start to reject many of the institutions of religion. She moves towards what I think we would today call a more humanist worldview. She embraces science and reason. This is something that's going to get her into trouble later on in her life. But she writes around this time, all religions on the face of the earth degrade women, and so long as women accept the position that they assign her, her emancipation is impossible. So she is already recognizing, particularly in the United States, particularly in pockets of New England and the eastern part of the U.S., the way in which these religious communities are consigning women to a very narrow role, a very narrow domestic sphere. And she recognizes that that's coming institutionally. That's not even coming from the government per se. It's coming from these societal influences. And it's something she's going to really scrape against throughout her career. Of course, that said, she does decide to get a little domestic herself. She does marry Henry Brewster Stanton. So that's where the Stanton comes from. She gets connected to him because of her involvement in the temperance and abolition movements. We say this a lot on the podcast, but there's a huge overlap between the suffrage and women's movement with temperance and abolition. Temperance and abolition provide women some of the first opportunities to engage in politics in our country and to engage in social change in our country. And so it's not surprising that that's how many of these people are connecting.
Super not. You can approach temperance in those days and abolition through the medium of religion. And that's an acceptable sphere for women at that time. And so that's how a lot of these women are gaining entree into these societies. She meets him kind of in a cute little way. Her cousin Garrett Smith has these salons in his home, and he would invite all sorts of people with like radical and semi-radical ideas. And she shows up and she meets this guy, and he's like, so you can imagine, he's the 1830s equivalent of a 60s radical. He doesn't have long hair, but you can imagine he's like a man about town. He's got these radical ideas, and he's a journalist, and he's going places, and she just they dig each other in a big, huge way.
Well, and I love to think about Elizabeth Cady Stanton's cousin, Garrett Smith, as like a little bit of the black sheep of the family. Like, he was radical, like helped fund John Brown's raid at Harper's Ferry later on, radical. And so I like the idea that Henry Stanton is maybe his leather jacket wearing kind of like wild bunch friends that she gets hooked up with.
And her family are not thrilled about this. They're like, yeah, honey, I don't think you should marry this guy. And Henry Stanton is about to go on a year-long trip to England. And so she basically has to decide, do I want to marry this guy right now? Or do I want to wait a year and my family will like endeavor to talk me out of this? And so she decides, always go with the guy in the leather jacket. This is my advice to everybody. She decides to go into it and she tells him point blank, I refuse to obey one with whom I am supposed to be entering an equal relationship. So she lays it on the line up front, like, this is going to be an equal partnership. We're going to be doing this together. I'm not going to be the little homemaker. She kind of sticks to it. They end up having 7 kids, and he does travel a lot, but they have a total of 7 children. The last one when she's 44. Wow.
I will note that she advocated for what she called voluntary motherhood, which was a pretty radical idea. Essentially, what she means is legally married women had very few rights when it came to relations with their husbands and with childbearing. She advocates that women have the right to decide when they are going to bear their children and if and how many. And so they practiced contraception. They practice birth control. She advised other women to do the same. This is radical, radical stuff for the pre-Civil War era. This idea that you don't just submit anytime your husband wants because it could result in a child. So you have to be thoughtful and you have to plan and you have to think about yourself. So she really was talking about autonomy over women's bodies at a time that was not talked about. It wasn't discussed. And she uses the sort of the phrase of voluntary motherhood. But what she's really talking about is birth control.
Yeah. They didn't have the language for it then, but that's exactly what it was. Yeah. They honeymoon in Europe. I mean, don't we all really? And while they're there, he's going for an anti-slavery convention. So he's a very prominent abolitionist, and that's kind of how she gets involved in this. And while she's there, she meets Lucretia Mott. Lucretia Mott is a Quaker, a feminist, and an abolitionist. She's also a minister. And the Quaker tradition, we've talked about this before, and I'm sure we'll talk about it again. The Quakers have a tradition of equality of the sexes. And so a lot of early abolitionists, a lot of early parts of the feminist movement are going to come from this Quaker tradition since they are brought up to believe women are the equal of men. And so Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton become friends. They bond over being denied participation in this conference. So women have been selected for this conference to be delegates, but they have to sit in a different section. So they're in this roped off section away from the male attendees.
Literally out of view. So the men don't have to see
right.
them.
So they're like there, but they're not there. And it's this very frustrating moment for her.
This is after their first denied entry even into the hall, which is so embarrassing and dehumanizing, and it's terrible.
Yes, it's just so terrible. Like, we're delegates here, but yet we can't enter the hall.
Also, we're all fighting for the same really good cause. That's, I think, what also gets me. Like, this is supposed to be to help end slavery. Don't you want everybody involved?
Right. And she makes this link, which you can kind of see how she makes it, that being married is like being a slave. I don't have any property rights as a married woman. I don't have the right to do anything. Just like as a slave, I'm supposed to submit just like a slave does. And so she makes this connection about women's equality through her connection to Lucretia Mott and through her abolitionist work.
I love that they meet at this sort of incredible situation in London. They meet, they become friendly, and then they don't see each other for a while. And then the next time she sees Lucretia Mott, it's going to be one of the pivotal moments in Stanton's life. Before we get to that, though, they move to Boston. That's where the Stantons settle initially in 1843. She loves living in Boston. He loves living in Boston. And it makes a lot of sense. That is really the epicenter of so many of these movements at this time. This is where the heart and soul of the abolitionist movement is. This is where the temperance movement is thriving. When she lives in Boston, she's going to meet Frederick Douglass, Louisa May Alcott, William Lloyd Garrison, all of these really important people who are going to influence her worldview, who are going to help her sharpen her oratory skills and her writing skills. But they have to leave because Boston is terrible in the winter. It's just awful. And her husband, Stanton, just cannot deal with the winters. So they go to Seneca Falls, New York, 4 years after 4 years in Boston. So they go, which I don't know if upstate New York is all that much better in terms of the winters.
That is my understanding. Yeah.
I say as a Southerner through and through.
I mean, Boston winters are legit terrible. I've lived in Boston. It's awful. But Seneca Falls, New York, it's not like we're at a different latitude here. Like,
but I guess maybe back in the 1840s, it was a milder winter. So they move there and Elizabeth Cady Stanton is bored. She's bored after living in Boston. She feels that she doesn't have the intellectual connections that she was used to. She feels very removed from the work of these movements. She starts to cultivate with some like-minded women. She tries to start to make some connections, but she's a little discontented. She writes, "The general discontent I felt with women's portion as wife, housekeeper, physician, and spiritual guide, the chaotic conditions into which everything fell without her constant supervision, and the wearied, anxious look of the majority of women impressed me with strong feeling that some active measures should be taken to remedy the wrongs of society in general and of women in particular." This is, to me, basically the feminine mystique 100 years earlier.
It's exactly what it is. I mean, women are subjected to this life that they don't particularly need or want, and they can't leave it because in those days, if you got a divorce, first of all, you were shunned, and second of all, you'd lose custody of your children. No one's going to leave their husband if they're going to lose custody of their children. You can't have an education. You can't have a job. You can't vote. You can't own property. And there's this awful double standard, whereas, first of all, men can do all these things, but men can also do a lot of other stuff in, like, the bedroom area that women are supposed to remain pure and stay at home. And she's like, you know what? I don't like this. I'm not down with this double standard.
She also, at a time where I think we don't always imagine women questioning these things, she's laying out here that being a mother and a wife and a homemaker is hard work. It's incredibly hard labor. And there's no recognition of that either. So when I was digging through her writing and stuff for this episode, this quote jumped at me, just knowing how hard it's been for so many people this year, being at home. And then we are talking so much about the ERA era that we've talked about the feminine mystique a lot, you and I. And so when I read this, I was like, oh my gosh, this is Betty for Dan 100 years earlier. So this is her state of mind, and she is, at this point in 1848, invited to have tea with Lucretia Mott and her sister, Lucretia Mott's sister, Martha Coffin Wright. They have tea at Lucretia Mott's house, and when they're having tea, they're talking about these things, talking about the movement, and they decide that they are going to organize the first women's rights convention, which will become known as the Seneca Falls Convention, July 19th and 20th. So we are recording this just a day after the anniversary of the Seneca Falls Convention, so 1848.
And they're surprised. It's gonna be a small thing, they think. They put one little ad in the newspaper and it's kind of on like page 5, and they expect, you know, a few dozen people to show up, maybe 50 or 60, and they end up with 300 attendees, all from the surrounding area, and it's a major conference. Now, it is not just women. So a couple of things about Seneca Falls. We think of it as being just women, and we think of it as being just about the right to vote, neither of which are true.
What I love is what Stanton and Lucretia Mott and Mott's sister, Martha Coffin Wright, really want for this is they want to talk about women's social rights, civic rights, and religious rights. Those were the three spheres that they wanted to talk about. So within that, there's obviously things like the right to vote, which we'll talk about in a moment, but they're not just interested in one thing. They're interested in elevating the status of women. They're interested in making headway into really living up to the promise of this country, but also particularly from the Quaker perspective that they're all equal in the eyes of God. So why aren't women being treated as equal in the eyes of their government? This is something that's very much part of Lucretia Mott's motivation, is her Quaker upbringing. So yeah, their scope, even though they're seeing this as maybe going to be a small thing, a small gathering of like-minded people, their scope for this convention is very broad.
Yes. They come up with the Declaration of Sentiments, which is written by Elizabeth Cady Stanton, has several clauses, some of which are not controversial and some of which are. In particular, the clause that Elizabeth Cady Stanton really pushes for is going to be clause number 9, which is that women should have the right to vote. This is very controversial. Stanton is going to insist on it over a lot of opposition, and it very narrowly passes. Frederick Douglass, by the way, was the only African-American man to attend the Seneca Falls Convention. He does vote for women's suffrage. He maintains a lifelong interest in women's suffrage and will actually sign the Declaration of Sentiments.
I will mention he's actually the only African-American period in attendance. So it is important to note, right, there are no women of color at this convention. This is going to be a thread through, I think, our episodes here. Is there's still exclusion, right? There is, while they see themselves as representing women broadly, often when they're talking and when they're writing and when they're engaging with women who share their background. So middle class to upper class educated white women. And that's important to note. I have to note my biggest pet peeve in how we learn American or women's history in America. Susan B. Anthony is not here. She is not at the Seneca Falls Convention. It is crazy to me, as important as Susan B. Anthony is, how much we wrap up kind of everything from 1848 to 1920 just on the shoulders of Susan B. Anthony. And she wasn't there. She didn't even know Elizabeth Cady Stanton yet. She doesn't know Lucretia Mott yet. So she is fighting for pay equality as a teacher at this time, but she is not here at this convention. So I want to point that out because I think it's a really common misconception.
Agreed. The other thing I will say about this, the Seneca Falls Convention, the Declaration of Sentiments is signed by 100 men and women, so not the full convention. Of the 168 of them are women. The one of the men is Frederick Douglass. And this is, I think, the coolest little factoid I discovered when I was doing research for this. I'm going to drop this on you. Of the 68 women that signed, one of them actually lives to see the 19th Amendment passed in 1920. Her name is Charlotte Woodward. She was 19. She came by a buggy to Seneca Falls. And she remains close to the movement for the rest of her life. She's involved in American Women's Suffrage Association and advancement of the Association for the Advancement of Women. And when women's suffrage is passed in 1920, she is 91 years old. And she is in very poor health because, again, she's 91 years old. And unfortunately, and she writes about this, she can't exercise the right to vote that November. She's blind. She's in very bad health. So she actually does not get to vote. But she does send that next year, she sends a trowel to the National Women's Party as sort of a gift from the only person still living who was attending at Seneca Falls. So that's my little, yeah, isn't that so cool?
I love that. I will mention, too, that 100 people sign, and then there's the press that surrounds this when it's over. And the press is pretty brutal. There are people who treat it as kind of an oddity, right? Look at these cute little women trying to organize this little convention. There are people who call it dangerous, who say that it's insidious, that it's an attack on all that's good and pure in the world. And there are these terrible political cartoons and editorials. And people who had signed their name publicly were shamed. In some towns, people actually had their names dragged into these editorials. And some people actually repudiated their signatures and asked to have their signatures removed after the fact because of the way they were treated. So what started out as something that they thought was kind of small scale, because of the success of the convention in many ways, they then were subjected to this terrible onslaught of opposition. And it's kind of the first time we see a really strong press cry against the work that these people are doing. A month later, there will be the second Women's Rights Convention in Rochester, New York. Elizabeth Cady Stanton is invited. She would speak there. This really solidifies her reputation as an activist, a reformer, and one of the faces of this movement because she organizes Seneca Falls and then goes to the next one. Susan B. Anthony's mother and sister are at the Rochester one, but she is not. So we're getting closer to Susan B., but not quite yet. After the Rochester Convention, another 119 people signed the Declaration of Sentiments. So they were able to almost double, more than double, the number of people. So they're gaining some success. And then finally, we come to 1851, to finally when Stanton and Anthony meet.
They meet on a street corner. Like, yeah. Totally, almost randomly. And they're introduced by a friend of Stanton's named Amelia Bloomer. Amelia Bloomer is the inventor of Bloomers, the clothing article, which Elizabeth Cady Stanton is a huge early advocate of. And in fact, her children really tell her they don't want to be seen in public with her when she's wearing Bloomers because it's very embarrassing for them. But she remains friends with Amelia Bloomer, and she introduces her to Susan B. Anthony. And it's Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton become fast friends, and they evolve one of these friendships that really, it's one of the more singular friendships, I think, in American history. It changes American history, and they're partners in almost every possible way. They remain close, mostly on and off, for the rest of their lives, and they really are an engine towards women's suffrage and women's equality. Elizabeth Cady Stanton will be the writer, and Susan B. Anthony will be the speech giver. And they talk about sort of this very singular partnership that they have. Susan B. Anthony does not have children. She never marries. But Elizabeth Cady Stanton has a full home life. And so there will be times when Susan B. Anthony will need a speech for whatever convention or article or whatever it is they're doing. And she'll tell Stanton, look, I need a speech. And Stanton's like, I'm making dinner and raising my children.
I'm running my household in addition to all this work I do.
Right, thanks. This is like my side gig. I have, you know, a home life. And so Susan B. Anthony will come over and take care of the kids and make the dinner so that Elizabeth Cady Stanton can sit at her kitchen table and write the speeches. So it's this really sort of singular partnership that the two of them engage in.
I think it's sort of amazing. These two women very quickly realize they are better served collaborating than working independently, because I think it says a lot about Elizabeth Cady Stanton that she can recognize that she has a lot to give to the movement, but because of her family, she can't pack up and go on a speaking tour across the country. She can't just go and travel and do things, that she needs to have some sort of counterbalance. And the way that they just instantly sort of connect and realize that if they merge their action, they won't just be twice as successful. They will be 10 times, right? Tenfold in their ability, and that they continue that through their lives. I find it fascinating. And it's why I'm so passionate about Elizabeth Cady Stanton having an equal amount of remembrance today to Susan B. Anthony, because everything they did together. They did entwined.
And I also feel like There's a lot of reasons I think that Elizabeth Cady Stanton has not gotten the kind of popularity that Susan B. Anthony has. Mm-hmm. And we'll get into more of that later. But I think one of them is this partnership, mm-hmm. is that it's much easier to grab onto Susan B. Anthony, who her whole life is the movement. Mm-hmm. Her whole life is the cause. She does not marry. She does not have children. Elizabeth Cady Stanton has a full personal life. She has 7 kids. She has grandchildren. The whole domestic thing. And I feel like we're so locked into seeing feminists as revolutionaries that it, particularly in those days, was difficult to see a woman who had the domestic success as a revolutionary as well. And I think that that's part of why Elizabeth Cady Stanton gets kind of pushed to the side a little bit.
Absolutely. I love when Elizabeth Cady Stanton dies, Susan B. Anthony said that Stanton forged the thunderbolts that Anthony fired. I love that description of how they work together. I just think it's so evocative and so cool. So these two women are going to be working together for the rest of their lives. 1868, we're going to have the Women's Suffrage Convention in Washington, D.C. Elizabeth Cady Stanton at this point is 52, so she's getting to be more of a senior leader in this movement, but she's by no means shy or quiet or old-fashioned. She gives a very fiery speech that casts men as the most destructive and dangerous element to society, and she calls it the male element. She says, the male element is a destructive force, stern, selfish, aggrandizing, loving war, violence, conquest, acquisition, breeding in the material and moral world, alike discord, disease, and death.
Yeah.
Eh? I mean, no lies detected,
same.
I guess. So this is interesting, though, and it's important because this is not just I think that women should have equal rights. I think women should have the vote. She's saying, look at where we are in 1868. Look at the 4 years of the Civil War. Look at enslavement in this country. Look at what has been perpetrated by men in our government and in our leadership. What good has come from it? And that's a compelling argument. I'm going to bring back to Lincoln again. Ford's Theater, the site of Lincoln's assassination, has an oratory contest. And one of the participants, this is a contest for students to present orations, historical orations, for scholarship money and prize money. And a couple years ago, a young woman did this speech, which I thought was such a bold choice to get up and do Elizabeth Cady Stanton's Male Element speech. So good on that young lady. But she sort of sees adding women's vote and voice to government as an equalizing force. If this is what men are doing, we have to have women so that we can balance them out, and that only a government of men and women can represent and protect the whole. Without it, we're skewing too far one way.
She actually is going to, around this time, become the first woman to run for Congress. I thought that was pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
It's like a loophole. 60 years like,
before she could vote for herself.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a loophole. Women can't vote for themselves, but there's nothing that says they can't run. She does not win. She gets like 24 votes, and she makes a joke that she wants to have her like two dozen supporters over and have a party with them. So she's kind of funny about it. But it's worth also spending a brief moment to talk about the 14th and 15th Amendment to the Constitution.
Yeah, this post-Civil War period is very important because we're starting to see where some of the rifts in the women's movement are going to occur. Serious rifts.
So the 14th Amendment, 15th Amendment of the Constitution are equal protection and the vote for African-American men. And Stanton and Susan B. Anthony both want women to be included in the 15th Amendment, that women should have, it should be universal suffrage. Women should get the right to vote. African-American men, white men should perhaps retain it, I guess. But they want it to be universal. And Frederick Douglass, who has been and will remain a supporter of women's suffrage, says, you know what? Now is not the women's hour. We've talked about this before when we talked about Frederick Douglass. It's this very hard moment of political exigency where African-American men are hated and they need the freed slaves need the right to vote in order to survive. Women do not need the right to vote. They're not being persecuted in the same way. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton's like, yeah, we are.
Which actually, Douglas and Stanton seem to forget about African-American women entirely.
Yes.
in that argument. This argument leaves out a whole group.
Yes. And it's just this horrible moment, particularly looking back on it from 2020, because no one gets what they want. The women get shut out of suffrage. African Americans get the 15th Amendment, but it's very quickly gutted, particularly in the South, and becomes a dead letter. So nobody gets what they want in this moment.
And it is going to hurt the movement. Stanton and Anthony don't just isolate from people like Frederick Douglass. Many of their abolitionists colleagues are going to split with them on this issue. Many of the women in the abolition movement go, it's not our time. Let's worry about other things. Let's support the 15th Amendment. Universal suffrage will kill this amendment, so we can't do it. And we see Elizabeth Cady Stanton's rhetoric shifting around this time. And it's troubling. It's troubling to hear some of the way that she starts to argue that women need the vote because can you trust African Americans at the polls? Can you trust immigrants? Why should these people, former slaves and immigrants who lack education or means, why should they vote when we have well-to-do white women of means who aren't allowed to? And those votes are needed to offset, right? She kind of argues that refinement matters more than just the inherent humanness of someone to vote. So it's complicated because she's calling for universal suffrage. She wants everybody to vote, but she's using a rhetoric to defend it that when you read it today, and even in that time, it's so divisive and it's so hurtful and it's so frustrating.
And it goes to, I think this is the real nugget of why she's not sort of better known today, is she uses this very classist, racist language in order to talk about the right to vote. And there is an argument, and I find some truck with this argument, but the argument is that she wanted to appeal to Democrats who were at that time the more socially conservative group. She wanted to appeal to them and get them on board, knowing that women are not going to get the right to vote unless they have bipartisan support. And so she starts using this language that's going to really appeal to Democrats who are at that time basically the party of white supremacy. Like, they're basically running ads that say, hey, support us because we'll protect white dudes. So she modifies her language in part to get their purchase towards women's suffrage. It does not work, but you can see the strategy. It also doesn't make it right, but you can see what she's trying to do. This is going to be the reason her legacy does not, that she does not have a legacy that Susan B. Anthony or Lucretia Mott does, because she sort of really goes almost all in with a lot of this racist, sort of very coded language.
Absolutely. And what she also does, and I think this impacts her legacy, is she basically splits the movement in two. So what we have in this era is now, instead of women working all together on the idea of suffrage and equal rights, we get the founding of two different parties with two different agendas. The first is the National Women's Suffrage Association, NWSA, that's founded by Anthony and Stanton in 1869. Stanton's the first president. She'll be president for 21 years. The whole purpose of founding the NWSA is to oppose the 15th Amendment if it doesn't include universal suffrage. This is not only, for the reasons we previously stated, problematic, and the language she's using problematic, but it also goes against what many supporters in the movement thought was a better strategy, which was state by state, working on passing voting rights on a state by state basis. Elizabeth Cady Stanton sort of saying a federal amendment or nothing, which is ultimately where the movement will go. But she's saying it in 1869. She also is advocating for more radical ideas in general. She is talking not just about the vote. She's talking about, what are my rights if I get divorced? What are my rights for childcare? What are my rights if I enter the workplace? Post-Civil War, as we become more industrialized, women are working more and starting to have opportunities to work more. Where are the protections in the workplace? And these are things that there are lots of other women in the movement that they don't want to address. So she's so unique to me because she's so progressive in some ways. And yet, because she's trying to appeal to Democrats very much, so she's trying to be bipartisan, she's not above using that language or throwing African-American men under the bus to try to get this suffrage. So it's so complicated. And yet, her NWSA has the support of Sojourner Truth. Sojourner Truth is saying, look, this 15th Amendment doesn't include me. What about Black women? Where are Black women in this conversation? You know, it's the entire concept of her speech, Ain't I a Woman, right? Like, where am I in this movement? And Truth ultimately will cast her lot with Anthony and Stanton, which I think says something, because they're at least saying, make it universal, make it for all.
Right. It's unfortunate, because what she really does is bring this racist element into the heart of the fight for women's suffrage that we will never that never leaves. It's there right up until 1920. And it's the black mark on the fight for women's suffrage that a lot of the arguments for suffrage are coded in this sort of racist language. But she's also at the same time very radical. She, for example, she wants to abolish corsets. She doesn't think women can be truly free, and she's probably not wrong about this, until they get rid of the, like, 20 pounds of whalebone corsets that are holding them in, and the stays, and, like, even something as simple as, like, going to the bathroom takes a while with this stuff. Women can't be free until they have the freedom of movement, literally, that men do. So she's really a radical, and she's really not at the same time.
The group that will form in opposition to Stanton and Anthony is the American Woman Suffrage Association, AWSA. It's founded in that same year. Lucy Stone, Elizabeth Blackwell, Julia Ward Howe. This is going to be the larger and better funded of the two groups. It is also going to be much more conservative socially and much more conservative in terms of religion. A lot of Stanton's ideas about religion are going to rub these women the wrong way. They are very much rooting the right for women to vote within the context of what a good Christian evangelical idea or Puritan idea of the role of women. They support the 15th Amendment, and they're kind of one thing at a time. These women are saying, let's get the 15th Amendment, then there will be all these African-American men who can vote, and that will help women get the vote. That's sort of their mentality, right? You'll get yours, and then we'll get ours. And they really don't care as much about the social change aspect, about fighting these sexist laws. There'll be two groups for about 11, 12 years at odds with each other. Eventually, by 1890, the leaders in both of these groups, with the exception of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, say, look, we have got to solidify. We cannot, this movement will wither on the vine if we cannot come together. So the two groups merged to become the National American Woman Suffrage Association. So if you've ever wondered why that name is so ridiculous, it's because the two groups merged and everybody had to have their letter. So when we talk about NASA, that's on this podcast in the next few months, that's what we mean, because it's a beast to say, National American Woman Suffrage Association. Elizabeth Cady Stanton hates this idea. She hates the idea of merging. She does not trust the religious radicals in this group. That's how she sees these conservative Christians. She is frustrated by their approach, not wanting to push for a federal amendment, but she agrees to serve as the first president. And she's basically chosen to be the first president of NASA just as a symbol. Look, we can come together. And even though a lot of us disagree, and she's our most controversial figure, we're going to make her president to show that we're all on the same page. That's the idea. What I like, though, about the 14th and 15th Amendment passing and these groups coming together is that these women go, okay, there's a 14th Amendment. Why does that not include us? And they start saying, hey, maybe our strategy is that instead of bothering with changing laws, we just go and vote and see what happens. And that's what they start to do.
And Susan B. Anthony's like, all right, I'm going to go do it. And she goes down and she votes. And then she gets arrested, which isn't great, but she gets arrested and they take her, the cops take her on a trolley ride. And when the guy's like, hi, you need to pay for your trolley ride. She's like, well, I'm riding courtesy of the government. They're paying for my ride. And so she basically tells the trolley guy, like, bill the government for this because I'm under arrest.
Yeah. She'll go vote. So will other women. Women like Victoria Woodhull will do the same thing. Elizabeth Cady Stanton actually does it as well. She attempts to vote in 1880 and is arrested, although not as flashy in the papers. But another way in which she and Susan B. Anthony sort of do the same thing. In 1878, she, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, will draft the first full text of a federal suffrage amendment text, which becomes the text of the 19th Amendment. So the text that we have comes from what Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote in 1878. So before Alice Paul, before some of the other women we're going to talk about in future episodes, Elizabeth Cady Stanton recognized that at the end of the day, all the organizing at the grassroots level is important, but if you're going to get women the vote, it has to be federally mandated. That's the only way to make it work and to make it lasting, something that can't be repealed or pulled back easily.
And she also is seeing at this time, and this is something that she's going to champion in her earlier years, states like Wyoming and Montana, Western states are coming into the Union with women's suffrage being a part of their statehood. So she see, you know, because they have a tradition out west of sort of more equality. In fact, Wyoming is called to this day the equality state because they enter the Union with women having the right to vote. And so she sees that it can be done. And she knows that it's going to take on the, particularly for Southern states, it's going to take it on the national level. They're just not going to get there on their own.
And truly, she lives long enough to see how quickly, even with a federal amendment, how quickly states can circumvent these laws, right? We see it with Jim Crow coming into this era. So she believes that very clear, specific language is going to be essential to ensuring this. She is going to stay involved with this movement through her later life. She'll actually testify before Congress, the House Judiciary Committee, on the issue of women's suffrage in 1892. This will be the last time she appears before Congress. She's part of a whole group of women who are going to be there, including Susan B. Anthony and Lucy Stone and a bunch of other people. She is going to give a speech, which will become the text of The Solitude of Self. Her testimony is so good that when Lucy Stone goes to publish what was said, she doesn't even include her own remarks because she's just like, Elizabeth Cady Stanton said it best. What she says is this: the strongest reason for giving women all the opportunities for higher education, for the full development of her faculties, her forces of mind and body, for giving her the most enlarged freedom of thought and action, a complete emancipation from all forms of bondage, of custom-dependent superstition, from all the crippling influences of fear, is the solitude and personal responsibility of her own individual life. The strongest reason why we ask for women a voice in the government under which she lives, in the religion she is asked to believe, equality in social life where she is the chief factor, a place in the trades and professions where she may earn her bread, is because of her birthright to self-sovereignty, because as an individual, she must rely on herself. And that's remarkable to me. What she's talking about here isn't just at the ballot box. She's talking about citizenship, and she's talking about back to the founding era, right? If we're going to have this idea of self-sovereignty, right? We have rights that are, we hold these truths to be self-evident. We have these inherent rights. That is what she's talking about. And she's talking about education and work and autonomy over your body, all sorts of really, really significant things. And it comes under the umbrella of the vote, but she's talking about a much bigger idea of full citizenship, truly, and full self.
And she's also talking about, she's situating women's equality in terms of life and death. And for women, it is. And she talks about that in this speech as well. She talks about how women need to be masters of their own destiny for their own safety. And that, you know, men can master their own destiny and women can. And it's the truly revolutionary thing about Elizabeth Cady Stanton, that she envisions this world where women can work and go to school and get divorced and vote and own property. And she sees this future for women when few other women of her era can sort of see that far. That's the really sort of revolutionary aspect of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, is she's so incredibly forward thinking.
I love it. The solitude of self is just, I think, one of the greatest things. And I think it also shows how much the United States has changed from the time she's born in 1815. She's given a speech in 1892. We have ideas of manifest destiny. We have ideas of the self-made man, this idea of self-destiny and expansion and growth. And so she's saying that women have a role in this, and women have just as much a right to this as any other American. And it's just so incredible. Now, a couple years after this, in 1895, she is going to produce a text that I also think very much explains why she gets shunted out of the early remembrances of this movement. She produces the Woman's Bible. She and a committee of 26 women write a book that challenges the traditional positions of religion, particularly all the places in the Bible where women are subservient and all the places in the Bible where women get a bad rap. So they rewrite sections of the Bible. They challenge the teachings of the Bible. This is a really big deal in 1895.
Yeah, she's going to rewrite part of the Bible to make it more gender inclusive. So she's going to take language that has been handed down for generations in the Bible and say that, no, this needs to be a little bit more gender inclusive.
The whole Adam and Eve thing, that's wrong.
Right, that's wrong. Just get rid of that. This is a radical act, particularly for an age that's much more religious than our own, that's so concentrated and focused on religion. This is a hugely important and very radical moment.
And for so many women in the movement who have come to suffrage
through religion
or religion adjacent groups like temperance and abolition, within her own movement, women are appalled.
Yes.
And outside of the movement, this is everything that people are afraid of, right? It's going to remove morality from the United States, that these women are God haters, that these women are immoral and unnatural. It's so, so controversial.
Right. You can see this confirming every single bad thing that has been said about
feminists. And then she puts out a second volume of it because at this point in her life, she's like,
why not?
You know, because it's what she truly believes. And she's so unusual with her sort of resistance to religion and her acknowledgement that every religion in the world, she said, she read as much as she could about every religion in the world, and not one she felt recognized women as equals.
And the other thing she does that's super controversial at this moment is she comes out publicly in support of interracial marriage, which is hugely revolutionary for its moment.
Yeah, abolition is one thing, but interracial marriage for a lot of the women in this movement is just insanity.
Again, and you're confirming all the worst fear corners of everybody who says, you know, we can't give African Americans the right to vote because then they'll be breeding with white people and this is terrible. And so she's confirming all of the worst fears about what equality will do for women. It will be a godless, terrible society full of feminists. And so it's just really, she ends this, her life. And I love that at the end of her life, she just gives zero crap about anything. She's like, yeah, this is what I'm going to say. And I'm going to say it. And I don't care if you don't like it. So I kind of dig that about her because I'm not near the end of my life, hopefully. And I'm like,
you
that.
Know, she's widowed at this point. Her children are grown. She's of age. Yeah. They're grown. And she kind of gets just more radicalized. And I love that the interracial marriage is actually what gets her friendship with Frederick Douglass back on track, because she's one of the very few people who will congratulate him publicly and write him personally when he remarries a white woman. And that ostracized him from so many people in so many groups. And she was like, happy for you. I think it's great. This is awesome. And they sort of rekindle their friendship over it. So again, just a fascinating portrait of a woman. She is going to write extensively in her later life. She'll write The History of Woman's Suffrage, a 6-volume work detailing the movement. She's going to kind of be one of the first people to say, we need to start documenting the work that's been done over 50 years.
And she writes this with Susan B. Anthony. And Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Stanton's, their relationship is not always smooth sailing. They kind of fall in and out. And at this point, they're kind of on the outs. And they're older at this point. And so they're basically like in this house together, the two of them. And this woman named Margaret Gage is like their buffer. Basically, I mean, she's got an official title like their secretary or whatever, but she's basically to buffer these two powerhouse women who are trying to write this volume of history.
Who are getting old and ornery.
Right, who are getting old and crotchety. At this point, they're like sisters. Like, you get to your, you know, older age and you're fighting with your siblings about stuff that happened 50 years ago. And that's kind of what Margaret Gage is there to kind of be a buffer. Margaret Gage, by the way, will later on go on to be she is at this point, the future mother-in-law of Frank Baum. Who wrote, Becca?
The Wizard of Oz.
The Wizard of Oz. There you go.
That's excellent. That is a nice little bit of overlap. She's also going to help edit and oversee Revolution Newspaper, which is going to be one of the newspapers that comes out of this movement. I meant to mention earlier when you mentioned Amelia Bloomer, one of my favorite things about Amelia Bloomer is she edited the first newspaper by and for women, The Lily, which was published basically after Seneca Falls. They wanted a way to keep these women who attended the convention in touch and aware of what was happening. So that's how the Lily began. If you are a fan of the present day Washington Post, as I know we both are, they have kind of a newsletter called The Lily, which is specifically for women's issues and women's news coverage today. So if you ever wondered why it's called The Lily, that's why it's named after the first paper, and that was Amelia Bloomer.
Oh, I love that.
Of course, back to Stanton. Stanton will remain super active. She does a 12-year speaking circuit as an orator on the Lyceum Circuit. She goes and does the things she couldn't have done 30 years earlier when she was raising her children and running her home. So she travels more. She speaks more. She's going to help prepare the founding of the International Council of Women. She's going to help lobby for suffrage bills in state legislatures. She's going to be very involved in New York with several bills, one of which will be very successful, which is a women's property bill to actually give women some property rights in the state of New York. And she dies in 1902 at the age of 86. So that puts her 18 years shy of the 19th Amendment. So pretty much her life's work, and this is a woman who lived a long time, and yet we're still almost 2 decades away from women having the right to vote. So when we talk about the struggle and the fight for women's suffrage, I mean, it really is a fight, and it's decades and decades and decades of work.
It's one of these things that I love when people say women were given the right to vote. And if anyone ever says this to you, friends, feel free to tell them, Rebecca said, no, women were not given anything. We fought for it. Thanks. But yeah, she sort of embodies so much of this early struggle towards the movement. And she, I think, had an awareness that she would not live to see women get the right to vote. I mean, obviously, she hoped that she would. But I think once you're in the movement long enough, particularly at that stage, you kind of read the lay of the land and recognize you may not live to see it. And so she's one of these women who do a lot of the groundwork so that the next generation and the generation following them can carry the torch and continue on. So she's really, I think, important in that way.
I'm thinking about some of the women we're going to be talking about in the next couple of weeks. And I think about they're born 40 years after Elizabeth Cady Stanton or 60 years after Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And already how much the world has changed, or how much the country had changed for women by the time they come along, and how much of that is due to the influence of women like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who are saying, not just we need the vote, but we need a voice in the public sphere. We need opportunities outside of the home. We need a chance to be thought of as equals in our marriages, in our partnerships, in business. She's talking about things that we still talk and argue about today in the 21st century in many ways.
And she's super great example of something that is going to thread throughout the women's movement and continues to this day, which is older generation of women become afraid that the younger generations will forget their struggle and forget the things that they work so hard to gain. And this continues to this day. Second wave feminists are afraid that the next generation are going to forget how hard it was. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton is the first bunch of these women who are afraid that the women who actually get the vote won't appreciate how much struggle there was. So there's this thread that kind of continues throughout the struggle for suffrage of making sure to tell the next generation how difficult it was and how hard we had to work for what we've got.
So we have Stanton dying, passing away in 1902, and this is almost immediately where her legacy sort of gets shunted off, because there is this sense at the turn of the century that if women are going to get the vote, they're going to have to change the course of action. They're going to have to energize a new generation, and they need someone to rally around. And they decide it is much easier to rally around Susan B. Anthony. We've talked about there are, I think, multiple reasons, not the least of which Susan B. Anthony outlives Elizabeth Cady Stanton. So Susan B. Anthony lives a little bit longer, but she fits the picture of a revolutionary. She doesn't marry. She doesn't have children. She was the more public face for so long of this movement, more out front, where Stanton was more back. She was a little bit more diplomatic. She didn't, throw herself against Christian groups and fighting against the 15th Amendment and all these things that make Stanton's legacy so much more complicated. So Susan B. Anthony is who everyone rallies around, and that's who the memory of her is so big in 1920. And even in the women's movement of the 1960s and 70s, they're rallying around this idea of Susan B. Anthony. In 1923, the 75th anniversary of the Seneca Falls Convention, there's a commemorative event there. And the only person who gets up to speak about Elizabeth Cady Stanton, the woman who made it happen and who wrote the Declaration of Sentiments, is her own daughter. She's the only person who would go and speak on her behalf. And that's so heartbreaking to me. And it's really not until female academic historians in the late 1970s, started to dig into Stanton's work that she started slowly to sort of peel out there. But even in prepping for this podcast, if you go to look on YouTube, for example, so much on Susan B. Anthony, so much, very little on Elizabeth Cady Stanton. When you look at podcasts, there's a handful of places there, but not that much. When you go and look at what's out there in the general culture about this movement, it's still so centered around Susan B. Anthony and this idea that she was sort of working alone. And, you know, Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton were like her helpers. And it's so a misrepresentation of the work of this movement. And so I hope that those listening today, as complicated as Stanton is, and certainly I think her legacy has a lot that could be picked apart and discussed, I think she's worthy of way more conversation than she gets. And I hope that with the centennial, we might have a chance to do that a little bit.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. I agree. If you're in D.C., there are a few places that you can see Elizabeth Cady Stanton. She is part of the portrait monument that's in the Capitol when the Capitol reopens someday. It's Lucretia Mott, Susan B. Anthony, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And the fourth part of the monument, this is the whole part of the point of the monument, the fourth part of it is unfinished. So there's a fourth woman to be added later at some point, hopefully when we have the first female president, maybe, I don't know.
To represent the leaders to come, the women to come.
Right, the leaders to come.
We just had a mini episode on the portrait monument. So if you haven't listened to that mini episode yet, you'll want to definitely dig in on that, because it features a really fascinating sculptor, but also digs in a little bit into that statue, which, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, had a very interesting legacy.
Yes. She has a bust at the Belmont Paul House, the headquarters of the National Women's Party. She has a portrait at the National Portrait Gallery. And there's part of an exhibit at the American History Museum called Creating Icons.
Yes. And in our show notes, we'll definitely drop a link to the Creating Icons exhibition at the National Museum of American History. That was part of the commemoration for 2020. They put together a great exhibit that looks mixed with artifacts, but really looks at the work of this movement over 200 years almost, looking at the legacy of the 19th Amendment. And there was some really great stuff. And I know they were really excited about that. And then the museum has been closed for COVID. But they have a great online component. So we'll be sure to link to that. We'll link to Belmont Paul as well in the National Portrait Gallery, so you can see some of these representations. I love Elizabeth Cady Stanton's portrait at the National Portrait Gallery because she insisted that for every portrait she sat for, she should have a female artist. So her portraits are done almost exclusively by female artists, which is great. I mean, that's a great use, I think, of someone who's privileged and has enough means to have things like art commissioned. And she helps support women in the arts and was like, if I'm going to spend this money, I'm going to do it to support a woman working in this field. So I love that about her. So this is our first of a series of four episodes, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. We mentioned some other really important women, though, Lucretia Mott, Susan B. Anthony. Those names will come up again, but we're going to be sort of moving along next week. Do you want to give a little preview out of next week's topic?
Yes. Next week, we are going to be talking about Ida B. Wells. She is going to be a later generation. She's born in the 1860s and is going to be present and involved in the 1920s in the fight for suffrage. But she's going to represent, and we're going to talk about the experience of African-American women with the suffrage movement. So she's a fascinating figure on her own, but she's also a great entry point to talking about something that really was at odds with the movement for a really long time, which is the African-American experience.
And we'll definitely be touching on a couple other events and a couple other women with Ida B. Wells as well. So next week will be very exciting. If you enjoyed today's podcast episode, be sure to like, subscribe, review. We love your reviews. However you listen to your podcast, be sure to like and review. Of course, we'd love to hear from you. So you can always email us, tourguidetellall@gmail.com. Let us know your thoughts, especially as part of the centennial for the 19th Amendment. We'd love to hear your questions, your thoughts. We'll answer those in future episodes. You can also tweet at us at tourguidetell on the Twitter. We share a little bit extra information on Twitter, so be sure to follow along. What else? Anything else?
Yeah, we'd love to engage with you. This is going to be really exciting. We're pretty stoked about the 100th anniversary and doing some really cool stuff. So we want to hear from you. And thanks very much for tuning in. And thanks particularly to our Patreon subscribers. We love you the most. And come back next week. We'll have more stuff.
All right. Until next time.
Bye.
Tour Guide Tell All is brought to you by some of the fine guides at DC by Foot, one of the many cities covered by free tours by foot. And as we start to reopen cities, we are giving private tours. Please check us out at freetoursbyfoot.com. Tour Guide Tell All is Rebecca Grawl, Rebecca Fackner, Candon Arciniega, and me, Dan King.